Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Joining me here this hour for 411 Teen panelists, I welcome students from FAMU. I welcome
Josh Johnson.
And Josh, what are you into?
I'm managing partner and CEO of Johnson Stevenson & Stevenson.
Okay.
I'm Braylon Miles, entrepreneur, student.
Camille Lewis, I'm a second-year graduate student in the community psychology program.
I'm Alicia Carter, I'm a junior in the psychology program.
I'm Brooklyn, I am a first-year community psych student.
My name is Nia Thompson, and I am a first-year community psych student as well.
Well, I welcome you all to 411 Teen.
Thank you.
If you're black, stay back. If you're brown, stick around. If you're yellow, you're mellow. If you're white, you're all right. America is becoming a multiracial country. It is formed by interracial unions and immigration. In both public and private interactions, race is significant. We are a visual species. We respond to the way one physically presents. Skin color is a signifier of identity and value. Racial categories are strained in the U.S. under the weight of our multi-hued, ethnically diverse, phenotypically ambiguous population. The complexion of America is changing with hues ranging from blue-black to sepia. Over 7 million Americans identify themselves as members of more than one race. Race still matters, but color matters too. In your opinion, how does America think about race and ethnicity? And whoever wants to go.
I think that's a complex question. I think that the overarching sentiment would be that race and ethnicity have always been something to gauge people, categorize people, maybe hold people back and set other people forward.
Others agree, disagree? Where do you sit on this?
I don't think America has changed too much about how they feel about race, you know, over the past couple hundred years. I think it presents itself differently with the climate that we're in. But I think America still has very racial undertones, and I feel like race dictates how people are treated, and it dictates a lot in our country.
Yeah, I agree about the racial undertones, but I also feel like they try to mask race as like we're all just one race, like we're more so American rather than African American or European or whatever. So I feel like it's more of a melting pot type situation instead of the tossed salad.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was going to say. I think racial prejudice is still running America. Like he said, I think it was suppressed until, President Trump was elected, and now, you know, racism is once again accepted.
Raised his ugly head again.
Exactly. So I'm kind of glad he was elected because it showed that the country is still just as racist as it always has been. So I think it's something they tried to push under the rug, try to make us feel like, I don't want to make it about us, but I'm going to go there. I feel like they try to make us feel as if we should erase 400 years in half a century, and I don't think that's okay. And I'm glad Trump was elected because now I feel like we can really attack it now. You know, with this younger generation of non-blacks who not necessarily raised on racism, but they can see, you know, what was real, what first was not.
I also feel like sometimes media plays a big role in it because you have these artists and, you know, these big faces that say, well, I haven't experienced racism, so racism isn't real to me. You know, you have one big artist like Lil Wayne. He said it multiple times. And then once he says this, he has a platform, so you have kids that look up to you and like, well, racism doesn't exist, so you have people believing it and following his footsteps, not saying that, you know, they'll say something, they'll be like, well, that's not racism to me, that's just their preference.
Right.
You know, they feel like they don't like my skin color just because they just don't like it. You know, they don't have to like it. It's their preference. And in fact, it's racism.
Yeah, I agree. I know a lot of times in America, we like to say we're so progressive opposed to other countries. But in reality, like someone said earlier, these covert attitudes, beliefs have just been that covered up when they're still there this entire time. And a lot of times, like Nia said, they like to say it's just one race. No, you telling me, oh, I don't see race, I don't see color. You don't see everything that's happening to me and everything that's impacting me.
When I say colorism or shadism, what comes to your mind?
I think slavery comes to my mind, and when I say that, and this is something that bothers me about our culture, is that we have let, I mean, at the end of the day, it was something that was ingrained into us, you know, separating each other by our different hues. And I think it's a problem, and I think that's one of the reasons why I don't feel like we've been able to come together and stick together as a culture, because we're the only culture who separates ourselves by the different shades, and it holds us back, and it's something that it really, really bothers me.
Well, I agree with you totally. I think I take one exception, because you do see colorism and shadism in other cultures or races. Mm-hmm. You see it a lot in Asia. You know, you see it in the Caribbean. You see it in Africa. So it's not something that is just indigenous to Black folks. I mean, it's all, hey, white folks have it too. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, they do want to look a particular way, but then again, they still want to make sure that they're perceived as white. So you have it in a lot of places. And it's interesting that you shared that, though, because I know when I said I was going to talk about colorism and shadism with some of my peers, they were like, what? Y'all gonna talk about that?
You're right. I heard that.
So you know where I'm coming from. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, so for the listening audience, colorism or shadism is discrimination based on the tone of one's skin. It's within the racial and ethnic groups as well as overall dominant community and society, so that they have a clear understanding what we're talking about. Do you make a distinction between racism and colorism?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's not a great distinction. Machiavelli wrote the book, The Prince.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite line, my excerpt from that book is, "You can cast the most horrible of vestiges upon your subjects if you give them the chances, no matter how slight, of becoming parts of the ruling classes." What he's saying is, vestiges, something that's long gone, mm-hmm. if you can place on somebody a value or something that is a value that's really not, you can make them want to be something that they're not. And so when you look at colorism or racism, that's the distinction. Colorism gives people a chance to aspire to something or to think that they're not a part of something, where racism mm-hmm. is the external push on that that says you're just not that, period, no matter what shade you are. So I do see a distinction, and I do think that colorism is more internalized. Racism is externalized.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say that racism, at least towards, you know, Black people in America, is white people's problem. Like, that's not our problem, that they have a problem with us. We have nothing to do with that. But I feel like colorism is our problem within our own community. Like, we need to learn how to not see different shades and see us all. We're just different shades of Black, but we're all Black. Mm-hmm. You know, so I do feel like there's a distinction and there's a difference, and it needs to be addressed in different ways. And I feel like racism, that's not our obligation to deal with races and to deal with the system, but I do feel like it's our obligation to heal our own community and to heal our understandings of how we view ourselves.
Other thoughts on this?
I believe that that Europeans pretty much created all the isms, racism, sexism, colorism. So I feel like racism is the top, and that everything else is kind of like a trickle-down effect. And colorism, like everyone said, affects us internally, and I feel that's why I was able to be invoked by the Black community, because it was it's basically how we were brought up, like, you know, from Willie Lynch letter and everything that separated us from the beginning. So it caused us to actually internalize it and then try to cope with it, but still make it like a taboo, like you said. So even though we've accepted it, we still don't talk about it. Like, it's there, but it's there, the elephant in the room. It's like, well, we know it's there, but it's okay. We'll just keep going. And I just feel like it's not helpful for sure. And it could be different because it's not a big deal. It's not something that we should actually feed into because it's something that they created. It's a construct. It's not even necessarily important.
Yeah. But I see, and let me just throw this in there. And then I see us, though, even today in 2019, feeding into it with a passion and a vigor. You mentioned the media. You look at videos. I mean, it's there.
Right.
And it's slapping you in the face all the time. That's all my only comment. I want to hear what you all have.
Okay, and like he was saying, I feel like colorism is a subsidiary of racism because when you're lighter, you try to cope with racism by saying you're closer to them. And I feel like that's what they want to, that, even going back to slavery terms and what I was saying earlier, might have been wrong on it just being black people, but I feel like it's heavier because it was used to oppress us and to separate us for real versus people just putting others down in other cultures because they're not of how they're supposed to look. So that's pretty much what I was saying earlier, but I do agree with what he was saying because they do accept. For me, example, I'm a barber and I cut. I have a wide range of customers, white boys, black boys, Spanish boys, and all. And just with my interactions with them, I see how they treat me versus how they would treat my other homeboys with tattoos, dreads, a lot darker skin. And even just going out sometimes with them, I can see how it's like you're the good black guy, you're the bad or the more dangerous black guy just off of appearance.
Off of color.
And to me, that doesn't make sense because I've never seen it that way. My father is dark skinned. So I've never seen, like, you know, I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me because, you know, in today's society, like she says, with the media, they try to pit dark skin versus light skin a lot. And just in black men now, all of a sudden, dark skinned women are a thing when I don't feel like it should be a difference because all black women are beautiful. So.
Yeah. They have this.
I think it's just a deeply rooted
hypersexualized.
Yeah, they have this. Oh, you're pretty for a black girl thing going on.
Right.
And it's
right.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Or you have nice hair. They'll say, oh, you have nice hair.
You tuned in to 411 Teen. This hour, we are talking about colorism. I have students from FAMU. We are going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This hour, we are talking about colorism or shadism, which is discrimination based on one's skin tone. I am very proud to have students from FAMU. Camille, you were getting ready to say something. I had to interrupt you, so let's go.
My comment was in regards to the media as well. So media can be used as like a negative aspect of colorism to point out dark skin and light skin. You know, you have the Beyoncé's and the, can't even think of the opposite from Beyoncé.
Kelly Rowland.
There you go. Or Kelly Rowland, you know, which one made it big. But also I feel like with social media now, it may be a fad to say dark skin girls are in or dark skin is this, dark skin is lit, but it's also for a generation underneath us who've never had the indoctrination of light skin, light skin, light skin. If they're coming into the social media world at 10, 11, 12, and this is what they're seeing, you know, that's going to have a lasting, at least I hope, would have a lasting impact on them and how they grow up so that the narrative and the conversation can start to change with the younger generation.
I definitely agree with you. What I think is so crazy is that, like, we see racism, we just see, like, this is such a big problem. But in our community, it's so often that we make jokes about colorism. We're like, oh, yeah, you know, only, like, dark-skinned dudes or, you know, only go for light-skinned girls when it doesn't have to be like that. And to piggyback on what you said, I definitely think that we need to emphasize our dark-skinned sisters who, like, people don't say anything about, really. Like, it's just kind of like, oh, well, like you said, the microaggression, like, oh, yeah, you cute for dark-skinned. Like, no, you're just beautiful in general.
Yeah.
And I definitely think we need to be pushing that on the next generation. Like, yes, to be oblivious to skin tone is, for lack of better words, to be dumb about it, basically. Mm-hmm. But it just needs to be black women in general are winning. Black men in general are winning. We don't need to continue to push this divide that we already know is there, that outside cultures and white people are already pushing on us. That needs to be us from the inside out. Mm-hmm. I know what you are. I see what you are, sister. I know. But I'm not going to continue to divide what we already know.
In other words, we're perpetuating it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Absolutely.
That's what I hear us saying. We are mm-hmm. the ones that continue this stuff. We keep it going.
To make the perpetuation as heavy as I can make it, a lot of people point to one large example of colorism globally, and that's the country of Jamaica, right? Mm-hmm. Jamaica is an all-black country. A dark country. Well, not all black, but mostly black, and a dark country. And starting with Jamaican independence, from Alexander Bustamante to Siaga to Manly to all of these guys are so bright, to current day Andrew Holness. Mm-hmm. All these guys are, and they're brilliant men, but to the visible eye, they almost look white. And now they are black, but you don't know that until you see their great-great-grandmothers. And it's almost as if the Jamaican people have internalized the power structure of, I'm not good enough to lead me, so I have to look outside. Now, these men were still brilliant, taking nothing from them. But a lot of their rise was because of how they looked.
That somebody asked me the other day if Barack Obama was dark-skinned, if he would still have been elected as president, or if he wasn't half-white, would he still be elected as president?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
I don't think so. I really don't. And you anticipated my question, because I was going to say, no, what about our last president? You know, what impact did his skin color play in his being, you know, elected? Because if he had been, you know, jet black, he wouldn't even got the nomination. What are you talking about? You know?
I heard that. As a matter of fact, Camille just let me hold the book with it, Americana. Uh-huh. And they talk about that in Americana. And the only thing that saved some of his substance intercommunally was the fact that his wife and that his family and that his prize was so dark.
Right.
Was so dark, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. What about family? I mean, how does family perpetuate this? Because we have parents who will tell you or reinforce racism or discrimination. And that's where that's part of where it's coming from. You know, you look in a family and, you know, they'll go from very fair to very dark. And often those members who are the very dark ones feel somewhat slighted, not quite as good, you know, whatever characteristic we want to attribute to it. But you all know where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. So what role do you think that our families play in this?
I believe our families play a big role, especially mine. I never knew that I was dark-skinned until I moved to the South, because my family, we were all dark-skinned, so it was like, okay, I just knew I was black. I didn't even know what that meant until, like, yeah, I got to the South and people would actually say things, and I'm like, okay, so I would go back to my mom, like, so what does that mean? Like, what does it mean that I'm dark-skinned? Is it different from everybody else? What's going on? And then she just, you know, of course, gave me the spiel, like, you're beautiful, da-da-da-da-da, and then my younger brother was born, and he was like really fair compared to the rest of us. So it was like, oh yeah, this is like the cutest little baby you had, and this, that, and the third. And I'm like, okay, y'all wasn't saying this 21 years ago when I was born. I was just fine. But now everything is different. And so I kind of internalized that a little bit, because I'm like, well, what's so different about my little brother? He's, you know, we come from the same parents. It's not the biggest deal, but he just favored, like, my grandma and had just a lighter tone than everyone else. But I guess I feel like that our families, they can perpetuate it, as we said, but they don't really realize that they're doing it. And it's more so just like things that have gone on in their minds or in their experiences that have compelled them to say things that they probably really don't have as much knowledge on.
Yeah, I think it's like she said, it's a subconscious thing, because I'm the only light-skinned person in my immediate family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, little remarks here and there about you being light-skinned, this, that, and the third. I mean, luckily, most of them, not luckily, but I didn't really get hair, like the hair treatment, because I actually don't have the best hair in my family, because I'm the only one. My dad's side of the family, he wasn't around, so it's just my mother and my stepfather's side of the family. So, Yeah, so I the same thing in the opposite way. Like, I'm the little brother that's light-skinned, you know.
Exactly.
But I'm not getting the praise. I'm getting the kind of, like, the opposite, like, the jokes. Like, you don't fit in with us because you're light-skinned. You know, all the emotion.
All those different things,
you know, so.
Growing up, I'm probably the darkest one. But this is about my actual grandma. And my grandma is, like, my color. But her daughter, so it's my great-grandma who's my color. My grandma, she's, like, fair.
Mm-hmm.
And she has two brothers and sisters who all is dark. And so they grew up in, like, the 60s. So she was like, well, I had it easy.
Yeah.
You know? She was like, but I fought for my brothers and sisters. But they'll be like, you don't need to fight for me because you got it easy. So she was able, she'll always say she was able to get the jobs that they weren't able to get. And so they will make fun of her because, like, well, see, you got it easy. She was like, no, I can't help what color I am.
Right.
You know, she told me about the time, like, they burnt, they took all their stuff out the lockers. And the white people threw them on the ground, her brothers and sisters. But hers were fine because you look like us, you know, you have hair like us. And she's always told me that.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, it's crazy to believe. You know? Mm-hmm.
And that's very typical. Any other situations that you can think of where, you know, there was clear discrimination because of your skin tone?
I think growing up, my family was very proud to be black. And if anything, like, I have vivid memories of my grandma kind of threatening us, like, you better not bring no white girl home. You better not bring no white boy home. Like, we need to keep our family as black as possible. So I think I got opposite programming as a child than a lot of other people got, because I used to want to be darker than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would sit in the sun and I would love to get tan because I just thought the darker the berry, the sweeter the juice.
Like,
you know, I loved being black and I thought black people were just so beautiful and I always wanted to be darker because I always, you know, just admired dark-skinned women.
Yeah, that's what my
grandmother
is now. She said,
I think we got an intersectional part here, because we were just talking about Barack Obama and would he have been elected if he weren't as bright as he was. But then when you turn the glove inside out and you listen to him speak about his earlier experiences, there were certain places in Chicago where he wasn't considered black amongst brothers until he would do something like play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always laugh because I'm 6'3", I'm dark skinned, people pick me first, and I can't dribble to save my life, right? And Barack, who can actually play, would have been run off the court because he was too bright skinned and talked too proper or whatever the reasoning was behind it.
Yeah, see, I'm sorry. I definitely agree with Camille. I mean, obviously the elephant in the room. So, like, my mom is white and my dad is black, but my grandma raised me. My dad's mom raised me. Because, you know, my mom had two jobs, two kids. There was a lot of working going on. But growing up, I'm from the Midwest, too, not from the South.
Okay.
Growing up, it was never like, oh, well, Brooklyn, you're so different than me because X, Y, and Z. And even my mom being white, I don't know what it was. I don't know if somebody spoke to her, but it was always like, find where you fit and feel most comfortable. I have an older brother. I can definitely say he aligns with the white side of my family. But me, I don't know if it was being raised by my grandma, but it was always, I feel a lot more comfortable here, so I'm gonna stay on this path. And from there, it was always just like, you need to be proud of who you are. You know, like, yeah, you might have a couple things mixed with you, but you know who you are, and you need to be proud of who you are. Don't try to be nobody else. Don't fake it till you make it. You need to be comfortable in who you are.
Okay. Do you recognize, and this is to all of you, but I know some of you are not from the South, a difference just as far as the location, the geographical location?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody's nodding their head. Let me hear from you.
For sure. I was born in Brooklyn, so in New York, it's like my cousins are Puerto Rican, and we're just a big mess pretty much, you know? So honestly, like I said, but when I was living up there, it wasn't even a thing. We all looked different. I had cousins that was high yellow and some that was as dark as me, but it wasn't until that I got to the South and, like, it was for sure, like, okay. And even here, compared to North Carolina, where I grew up, I feel it's also a little more, has a lot more racial tension than compared to North Carolina, which is, you know, just a bit more north than Florida. But I felt like it gets a little more thicker the more you get past the Mason-Dixon line. It's like, you know, everybody is a little more chill up north when it comes to differences, because coming from the Caribbean is where my family is from. Everybody is like, we're just, it's a bunch of stuff. And then New York being a really big place for immigration, we never really could tell the difference between people. It was all more about, like, how well you could cook. Like, who's throwing the best house parties and things like that. It wasn't really divided by skin color, I would say, compared to the South.
Okay.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. So I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, and okay.
Yeah, so it's definitely a good mix of everybody up there. Literally everybody.
I know Columbus well. I went to Ohio State undergrad.
Oh, it's like 15 minutes from me.
Oh, okay.
But it wasn't until I went to Alabama State undergrad. Okay. It wasn't until I came down south. You know, you always hear stories of, like, this is what racism is. This is what it looks like. And I don't know if I was in Columbus behind my veil of ignorance. But when I got down south, I was like, wow, this is real. I was like, I'm literally being called light-skinned, high yellow, red bone. Like, I'm just black. What you mean? But it's definitely a stark difference.
Okay.
Yeah, I had the same experience coming from California. I lived in San Francisco. And when we moved, and my best friend was Asian. Like, I don't think I had a concept of race until I moved down here. And I moved to the south side of Tallahassee in an all-black neighborhood, went to an all-black school, and I was like, had a little culture shock, because I was like, I've never been around so many black people. And then they would pick on me because of the way I talk. And they would say, oh, you talk white. You're like, that was the first time I'm starting to hear these, you know, these messages that black children get in the South about either not being black enough or being too black, you know. So that was my introduction to the South.
Yeah, I'm from Fort Myers, so, but like, only thing I experienced growing up was that I talked too white, I was like, what? I'm proper. I talk proper. That was it, really. I moved to Tallahassee in 2015. I went to USF. And so there we experienced things with white folks, like always. They said, go home, niggers, and all this other crazy stuff to us.
Wow.
That's about it. That's, yeah. Okay.
I grew up with the maxim that my grandmother used to tell me, and I've since shared it because I don't want the responsibility of it, but she would say, you're tall, you're black, and you're black. In the South, it don't matter how close you get, just don't go too high. And in the North, it don't matter how high you get, just don't get too close. And even though, like I say, I've shared it because I don't want the weight of that on my mind, it is true. In the South, you can go in people's homes, you can eat with people, you can love people, but don't be my supervisor at work. And in the North, I don't mind if you're my supervisor at work, but let's not come to my house. And it is a clear distinction, the South and the North, racially. It really is. It really is.
Okay. Well, I'd like to have you all, for the listening audience, talk about the brown paper bag test. I know you all know about that, or the comb test, or the pencil test, or the all those tests. But let's start out with the brown paper bag test. Who would like to share exactly what these tests were about?
I know at the Cotton Club that people weren't allowed to perform there if they couldn't pass the brown paper bag test. That's right. How they had to do to be a performer.
Right. And for those who don't know what we mean, you would take a paper bag and put your hand next to it. And if you were darker than the paper bag, then you were not accepted. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or the same thing with the comb test. If you could comb through the hair easily, then that was okay. But if it got caught, then there was a problem, okay? So I know they had door tests. I mean, you go to the door and, you know, this was popular at clubs and churches and whatever to determine whether you could enter or not. I guess those don't exist anymore, or do they?
I think socially,
that's what I was looking for.
Well, even being at a university, and this is purely my observation because I didn't attend FAMU for undergraduate, but when I look at different sororities and fraternities, you can still see it. They almost still fit that stereotypical stereotype. The AKAs are light skin, Delta's a dark skin, the Kappa's a light skin. Like, they still kind of, I think, gravitate towards these stereotypes. They want to be part of a stereotype, almost like.
Okay. other comments? I mean, you're at a HBCU. Do you feel, besides the sororities and fraternities, do you feel any type of difference or distinction that is made?
I feel like that there are stereotypes that definitely come with skin color. Like, sometimes people would tell me, like, oh, your name is Nia? Like, I'm surprised you look like Shaniqua. Like, you look like, you know, I'm just kidding. Yeah, they would really be like, that's so simple. I would never think that you could just be a Nia, and then I talk so well. So, it's like, I think
you're articulate. Yeah. You know, that's the way they describe it.
Right, exactly.
You're so
like,
articulate.
Exactly. Like, I'm just speaking just like you. But I feel that oftentimes we'll put those stereotypes on people and expect that from them. So it's like, oh, you light skin, curly hair, you should be a model. Like, mm-hmm, you should definitely mm-hmm, do that. Like, mm-hmm, I can see you mm-hmm. in the music industry. So I just think that it's just often placed on us without even, you know, they say you make assumptions within like a minute. So
and we do it.
Absolutely.
I know I'm guilty of assuming things about people based on how they look, especially mm-hmm. like when it comes to men. I see like a light skinned man, like, oh, he a pretty boy, like, right. You know, like I automatically yeah. have these thoughts rolling through my head. So it's not like I'm immune to them, but I am aware of them. And sometimes, okay. a lot of times, I have to check myself because okay. right. you know, I know what I'm doing. I know yeah. why I'm thinking those thoughts. So a lot of my day involves me checking myself.
And mm-hmm. why, real quickly, do you think you're thinking those thoughts?
Because historically, it's been put in my mind through the media, through the movies, through the music, through the books, mm-hmm. through the school system, through the curriculum, everything. Through my neighborhood.
But I think that yeah. introspection is really important because we yeah. don't yeah. often do it. And, you know, back in the day, I would be a hater, I ain't gonna lie, team dark skin. I am what I am. But I feel like I shouldn't do that, you know? You okay. should come back Shit. To them.
You tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You tuned in to 411 Teen. And this hour, I have students from FAMU. We're talking about shadism, a colorism. You had some comments I didn't get to you before we went on break.
Yes, yes. She just mentioned something that I've dealt with my whole life. Women pre-assuming because I'm light-skinned, I'm a pretty boy, and all these things. And, you know, I've gotten used to it because, you know, it is what it is. But once people get to know me, they understand I'm like, I wouldn't say I'm the opposite, but, you know, I like to look well, but I'm the opposite of what a quote-unquote light-skinned male mm-hmm. is necessarily. So I think that's something that we definitely need to eradicate because, honestly, you know, of course, I'm a male. I have a lot of friends. I feel like it's all just the type of person a person is because I have a number of male friends that are dark skinned that are more, they care about their appearance and you mm-hmm. know, being more pretty than, you know, most women. Mm-hmm. And I do, and I can't help the fact that like if any of you all were to see my mom, you probably think that's me with a wig on. So like I really do look exactly like my mother. So like growing up, I didn't have no facial hair, I had a real baby face, and I still do. So you know, I've always been called pretty and all these different things, and it's always bothered me like to the core. Like I've always wanted really? To be darker, more mean, masculine looking, and for mm-hmm. the longest. It's something I dealt with, and I got into a lot of arguments, fights, and just, you know, just self-hate over.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you correlate being darker and being mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, like, and this is another thing, even with males, like, I'm offering, and even growing up, I went to all-black high school in Orlando, and even growing up, you know, you're more inclined to get tried or stepped up to because I don't look intimidating. I might think the same thing as the average person. I might actually be the same way, but I've noticed, and I'm an observant person, so I've noticed people act a certain way with another person and try something with me that they, you know, they wouldn't try with that person, and then be confused or shocked when I responded a certain way, and I would always catch a hesitation, and it's just interesting to me because I see it now, and I had to recently, like as of the last year, just kind of like come to acceptance with it. instead of getting so upset. Because I've gotten into a lot of trouble, just not like trouble with law or anything, but just like in a lot of altercation with a lot of people just because of that. And it had me like not hating myself, but it definitely had me like questioning why I am, why did I have to be like this, you know what I'm saying? So yeah. Something that really bothers me, because I love black people and I love our culture and I love us, and I hate that we separate each other from colorism. I hate it with the core.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. You anticipated my question, because I was going to say, think about how has colorism impacted your life? How has it impacted you directly as far as who you are and what you do and how you handle things even, you know? But when we look at someone, you know, just that nonverbal communication, think about how we describe them. Is our goal to be a colorblind society? And I'm throwing all these questions at you, you can answer, but, you know, I'm just thinking as we've been talking.
As a kid, my mom put me in swimming lessons, and so a lot of black kids can't swim from where I'm from. And so, oh, yeah, you are a white girl because you do swim. And I was on the swim team. I'm also a certified diver. I'm also a certified lifeguard.
You ain't supposed to have all that stuff.
Right.
You know, hair is full.
Exactly. That's what, you know, that's what, so your hair gonna fall out.
Right.
My hair is healthy, you know. Mm-hmm. And as I was a marine bio student at USF, and my professor was like, you know, only like 0.2% people become marine biologists, and not many of them are black folks.
Mm.
You know, and you get this, and it's like, what does it have to do with, I just want to be with the sharks. I love sharks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and white people, they were just like, yeah, you can swim. That's not like many people.
Right.
You know, and I was on a swim team, and I went to a swimmate's house, and it was like, you're like a fly in milk in here.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm just like, what?
Ooh,
yeah. And that just stuck with me mm-hmm. for a very long time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was, like, years ago. Mm-hmm. That was my fly fifth grade
milk. Fly in milk.
That's different.
Fly in milk in here because I was the only black girl on the swim team.
Mm-hmm.
I just like to swim.
Yeah, I definitely think it goes with you for a long time. And it's never really one experience. It's a lot of different experiences. It's like, okay, so I need to know this is how I'm going to address these things. I'm either going to deal with it or I'm going to kind of suppress it. And honestly, it was, for me, it was a suppressing type thing for a long time. Like, okay, I get to see who's really for me. You know, I'll get to decide who really just likes me for me without making it like a big deal.
Yeah.
But then I also felt like that wasn't healthy either. Like, you know, I should express that, you know, how I feel and what I think is beautiful and how I feel about other people and how I think they feel about me. So I think more of just talking about it and just expressing yourself and, you know, just understanding and expecting and accepting people for who they are and, like, their beautiful qualities.
And I also think it's just a display of other people's insecurities on to you. Like, with the dark skin thing versus the light skin thing, I think it's just a display of insecurity. Like, darker brothers growing up feeling inferior or feeling lesser than themselves, and now that, you know, we get older, they've had to put on that, all that hurt, you know, is built up, and then it's now like, let me take this out on the person who I feel like had an easier life growing up,
mm-hmm.
just because of skin tone, because, you know, that's really how it is. And then even, it was sad, because I was talking to my one of my friends who's from Miami. He cut his dreads off a while back, but he said he wants to get them back. And I was like, why not, bro? Just get them back. He was like, no, you don't understand. Like, I have tattoos. You know, if I grow my dreads back, I can't, you know, I can't do these things. He was like, it's not like I'm like you. You can grow your dreads and you'll be fine. And it just, and we was like, we had like an hour long conversation about it. And it was just like real saddening, because he really wants his dreads back. But it's because, you know, we have to assimilate to what the white man wants us to look like in order for them to feel safe, that we can't even be ourselves.
I think if your friend was to consider his hair not dreads, and you say these are locks,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing dreadful about his hair.
Mm-hmm.
And once he realizes there's nothing dreadful about his hair, he's going to wear his crown how he wears his crown, regardless mm-hmm. of what anyone thinks of it.
That's what I was trying to tell him.
Now. My hair's going to stay like this for a very long time.
And something I even want to do, just to express, I want to grow my dreads, and you know what I'm saying, just to be a role model for the kids that mm-hmm. that feel like we have to be a certain way to, you know, appease certain people, you know. So I think that's something that we have to take upon ourselves first.
Yeah, but you got to keep reality, like, in the forefront of your mind. Because the reality is, in America, light-skinned people do have it easier. Yeah. Like, a job, you know, they do discriminate based on skin color. They do discriminate based on hairstyles. Like, we can be ourselves, but let's not forget where we are. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, like, you want to be a spy when you go to war, or you want to be a warrior. Like, either way, you got to get what you need. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's healthy to ignore the fact that we're in a racist society and ignore the fact that our color does impact our lives and ignore the fact that it plays a part in who gets accepted where and who gets what position. Like, it's a reality, going back to Obama. Mm-hmm. It's real. And he played the light-skinned card because they chose a light-skinned man. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we can't ignore reality.
And I completely understand it, but my question to that is, with, okay, we face reality, but do we not use ways to get around it by still being ourselves? Like, that's why I think we need to own more. Entrepreneurship is, I feel like, is that path. Ownership is that path we can take to taking all of those things back, in my opinion. Because I feel like with him, I told him, I said, bro, if why don't you feel like you can wear dreads because you want to get a job? Why get a job when you have these qualities that, you have the qualities to be a successful entrepreneur, man. I don't see why you can't do these things. Because I do understand that me and him walking in the room, they're gonna see him and, you know, think a certain way. See me think a certain way. So I do understand those things, but I don't like for those things to hold us back and to be mental barriers for success and feeling like we have to, like I say, similar to a culture that's not even us. Because I feel like at the end of the day, we have a real rich culture, and, you know, I feel like the white man monetizes it.
I feel like the dual mindset kind of comes into play there. That's when we gotta, like, okay, we know what we up against. Mm-hmm. So now it's time for us to come together, say we gonna do this to please them, but we also gotta make sure we're uplifting each other to make sure we're about to get around this, that we're gonna be strong enough to stand on our own 2 feet and not have to worry or live by their standards. So I feel like that does take time. Of course, you know, we're millennials, so we want stuff to happen yesterday.
Yes.
So I feel like in order for that to happen, that's when those family and, you know, family relationships and building come to play, and us uplifting each other, so that way we could actually be able to have some kind of grounds to where, yeah, we could say, nah, we good on that. We're going to do it our way.
So what I hear you say, let me just throw this in and go right here. But what I hear you saying is that color really is a signifier of value and of identity. Mm-hmm. But we need to be able to play the game.
Right.
I mean, that's the reality, it sounds like. I mean, if you want to get a job, if you want to do the, you know, there's certain ways we have to look.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Go right ahead.
I don't agree.
Okay, you don't.
I do see the significance and the reality to it. Mm-hmm. And before this previous election cycle, I ran for office. I ran for the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. And I ran as a dark-skinned man in a majority white district, an extremely white to affluent district. Knocking on people's doors, in my campaign, was an extremely different experience than my white counterparts, because you get up at 8:30 in the morning in some of these neighborhoods on the east side of town, and you're knocking on doors, and when they answer, you're a candidate. But before they answer, you're a suspect. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it goes. And so I would see myself thinking, not really wanting to, but if I was a lighter skinned guy, I would be able to maneuver better. But then, not even a year later, my sister, who's extremely bright skinned, was kicked out of her private school for wearing her afro. 4.0 student, the head of her class, her senior year, she had been wearing it her whole life. The Colin Kaepernick things caused some frictions, and her afro caused her to be kicked out. And so I don't think there's a way around it. I think the only way around it, like this guy said, is either ownership, pride, and promulgating things that you can cling to in your own success instead of wondering when somebody's going to give me something. I'm not, which is why I wear my hair like this today. Mm-hmm. I do it on purpose.
And another thing I was going to say, it takes brothers like him, brothers like Jay-Z, Freeform Dreads now, mm-hmm. billionaire, mm-hmm. showing other young, aspiring black people, black kids, that, okay, I can be just like him and be myself. Mm-hmm. And that's why he does it, and that's why me, I have high aspirations, and what I want to show is my black culture, like, You know, I love like the artist Kodak with the hair. You know, I love the different cultures being like the different parts of our diverse culture being showcased, you know, and successful with their success. So that's one thing I feel like is gonna take us to new leaps, is just people with high influence pushing our culture.
It's you as well, how you carry yourself.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Because I have a 17-year-old brother, and I also have a 13-year-old cousin. And they were like, oh, my hair like yours, but my people won't probably like it, huh? And I was like, you know, you do your hair how you want to do it. And next, my brother now has freeform locks like mine. He was like, see, my hair is like yours now. And so does my cousin. And just be an influence to, because this is about the teens. You know, the teens see you as a young adult, and they do what you do.
They emulate.
Exactly. And so you want to be a leader to those that's going to lead after you.
And don't also associate money and success with being yourself. Correct. You know, because oftentimes they'll see that like, oh, when I can get there, that's when I can be me. Like, I can't do it right now because I'm not, you know, where I want to be in life. But that's not necessarily true.
Correct. I tell my brother all the time, you don't need those new shoes.
Right.
It's like, yeah, but man, you know, everybody has them. I was like, yeah. Okay. They have them a long time ago, too.
Why as a people, though, are we so reluctant to have this conversation? I mean, I told you the kind of response I got when I said I was talking about, you know, I was going to talk about colorism. On your program, you're going to talk about colorism. You know, and that was some of the response I get. And it's like, it's okay to talk about it in the corner where nobody can hear you. Okay, but you putting it all out there, you know, how do you feel what you're doing, you know? But so why is that? What's going on?
I have the conversation all the time. And unless I'm having a conversation with somebody who's very like-minded like me, the response I get is, here she go with that black stuff. Why you always got to bring race into everything, you know? Yeah. And I feel like this society is kind of conditioned us to think it's a melting pot and not to talk about race. And by talking about race, we're dividing ourselves more, which is the opposite. Like, we need to get these racial socialization messages, and we need to talk about race to actually bring us together and heal the wound.
Exactly. So, I think that's 100%. A big problem, is that people don't even want to face the fact that they are even hurt by it. Like, oh, no, I'm going to take that one. I'm going to charge to the game. That's okay. It never really affected me. I'll be all right. But all in all, it's like, when you really talk about it, you probably be in tears afterwards because of what people said to you. So it is like more of a, are you ready to talk about this type of thing, and not when will we talk about it? Yeah.
And I feel like some people feel like it's one of those things like beating a dead horse. I don't feel like people think anything can be done. Because, you know, at one point in my life, before I was awakened, I feel
you woke now. You woke, bro.
Yes, ma'am. Before I was awakened, I would always be like, "Why even try to fight it? It's nothing that's gonna be. We're not gonna be able to do anything about it. It's no point. You know, it's beating a dead horse." But you know, I've done my research. I've been enlightened, and I understand that it's something that a lot of, like you say, a lot of our people, and even my parents, like, people don't want to talk about it because people feel like it's an excuse. You know, just these different things, or you're doing the most, you're trying to make it, well, you know, we should be over it by now. But it's like, the more you learn, the more you realize how prevalent it is and how it's just right in our faces and we don't even see it.
Right.
And I think it's just a fear thing. It's like we don't want to work hard. We don't want to, you know, sacrifice certain things. You know, we don't want to sacrifice our livelihood for the betterment of our people, because we're worried about ourselves. So that's definitely a big thing, because I know even just like mentors I've had, like, they've always told me to do things this way, do the thing this way. Like, one told me wear a certain watch to appease the white man, you know, wear a certain tie, you know, different things like that. And growing up, I'm like, okay, yeah. But now it's like, why?
Right.
Yeah.
Starting to
why can't I be successful, you know, the other way? Why do I have to get a job and work for someone to do these things and dress and act like they want me to act when, you know? So that's what I can go all day.
Yeah. See, I think why a lot of people choose not to have this conversation is that we have to admit that there's a problem inside. Okay. So often we like to point the finger to the outside, like, oh, well, it's because of this, and, well, we have X, Y, and Z problems going on. Sometimes you have to turn home. Sometimes you have to address problems at home before you can address what's going on outside the home.
Yeah. That was my... She took the words out of my mouth. There are several ways to treat cancer. You can take chemo. Sometimes you got to be cut on, and nobody wants to be cut. Nobody wants to go inside and admit that some of this stuff we do to ourselves.
Well, we are out of time, and I always say thank you. Thank you, thank you. Much appreciation. To my listening audience, thanks for your ear and your time. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.